You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. For nearly a century, the Cecil Hotel in downtown Los Angeles has been linked to some of the city's most notorious activity, from untimely deaths to housing serial killers. In 2013, college student Elisa Lam was staying at the Cecil when she vanished, igniting a media frenzy and mobilizing a global community of internet detectives eager to solve the case. Lam's disappearance, the latest chapter in the hotel's complex history, offers a chilling and captivating lens into one of LA's most nefarious settings. In season one of a new Netflix docuseries that deconstructs the mythology and mystery surrounding infamous locations in contemporary crime. The series is called Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. And today, I welcome the director, acclaimed true crime documentarian Joe Berlinger, back to the show to discuss the dark history of the Cecil and why the socioeconomics of downtown Los Angeles have made it a haven for the downtrodden, desperate, and despicable, including one of the worst serial killers of all time, Richard Ramirez, a.k.a. the Night Stalker. We talk about the mysterious disappearance of Elisa Lam, whose body was later found in a tank on the roof that provided the hotel's water supply, the bizarre elevator footage that fed all kinds of media speculation around the case, and some of the even more bizarre conspiracy theories propagated by a community of online web sleuths. Coming up with documentary filmmaker Joe Berlinger in just a moment. Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel is the first season in a new documentary series that deconstructs the mythology and mystery surrounding infamous locations in contemporary crime. The idea for Crime Scene sprung from the mind of award-winning director Joe Berlinger, whose previous true crime documentaries include Conversations with a Killer, The Ted Bundy Tapes, and Paradise Lost. And today I'm happy to welcome Joe back to the podcast to talk about arguably the spookiest building in Los Angeles and the mysterious disappearance that took place there in 2013. Joe, how you doing?
Glad to be back. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And like I said, you have been instrumental in the surge of the popularity of true crime documentaries and docuseries for a while now. And I absolutely love this new angle that hones in on the settings of infamous crimes. The kind of places like the Cecil Hotel, of course, which you feature in the show, or, I don't know, Spawn Ranch, the Lizzie Borden House, places that almost take on a life of their own. How did you come up with this idea?
You know, what is it about a place that makes it an accomplice to crime or the perception of crime? These are ideas that I've thought about but haven't really had a chance to scratch that itch in my other projects, because my other projects are much more focused on an individual crime or an unfolding situation. What is it about when I did my Whitey Bulger film, what is it about South Boston that produced a very specific kind of Irish gang, you know, the Winter Hill Gang and Whitey Bulger? What is it about that environment? Or is it just coincidental? Mm. You know, what is it about the Pacific Northwest, and the geography of that area and the social economic circumstances that allowed a Ted Bundy not only to exist, but to flourish? What is it about West Memphis, Arkansas that allowed people to jump to the wrong conclusion without any evidence that these three teenagers were devil worshiping, you know, teens that sacrificed 3 8-year-olds to an alleged satanic ritual, which we all know now never happened, and it was a wrongful conviction. So, you know, I've toiled with these ideas or pondered about these ideas in the past, but never really explored it. So when the idea of covering the Elisa Lam story was brought to me, I kind of wanted to take the true crime genre a little bit and turn it on its head and not focus on an individual crime or an individual criminal, but really look at a place and mm-hmm. what are the factors that make, you know, criminality or the perception of crime happen.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that angle of it. The Cecil really is a character in season one. And coming from LA, I'm fairly familiar with the Cecil and the lore around it. But for anyone who might not be familiar, tell us a little bit about the history of this place.
Yeah, well, the Cecil Hotel opened in a very different downtown Los Angeles, you know, in the 20s. I think the hotel opened in 1924, but, you know, in the 20s, downtown LA was the place to be. There was, you know, public transportation that brought people to that center of Los Angeles. Businessmen would come from all over the country. Downtown Los Angeles was a, you know, very happening place. Downtown LA over the decades has fallen into a state of disrepair. In the last decade or so, there's been lots of urban renewal. But, you know, it's an area that has seen, you know, it's the heart of Skid Row in L.A. There's a tremendous homelessness problem there. For a long period of time, L.A., I think, had a, you know, terrible policy of, you know, containment. In other words, a lot of homeless people were kind of dropped off there, or people with mental health problems. And really, the city was just trying to keep them contained in this one zone. And so, over the years, that part of town fell into disrepair. It's come back, but there's still a massive homeless problem there, and, you know, a large Skid Row even today. And so through it all has stood this magnificent building, you know, this classic Beaux-Arts hotel that was built, you know, with you know, the best materials, and was kind of a gleaming, you know, marvel in the, you know, early 20s. And this hotel has, you know, itself fallen on, you know, a state of disrepair. And strangely enough, it's been the scene of more than its share of crime. We've had two serial killers working out of the Cecil Hotel, the night stalker Richard Ramirez and this Austrian serial killer Jack Unterweger. You know, it wouldn't be unusual for Unterweger to come back, you know, after his kills and covered in blood, removing his clothes, and people just didn't, you know, think anything of it.
Yeah, that's just the kind of shit that happens at the Cecil.
That kind of happened at the Cecil Hotel. Right.
Didn't bat an eye.
You know, and then in subsequent years, In the mid 2000s, you know, the hotel tried to reinvent itself. They created a separate hostel within the hotel called Stay on Main. So if you were a young budget traveler and you Googled, you know, downtown LA hotels, you'd get see an ad for Stay on Main with, you know, bright, cheery orange colors. And that hotel within a hotel was within this, you know, Hotel Cecil, which had a tremendous history. You know, tremendous dark history of all of these strange happenings, you know, and there was a shared elevator. So, and by this time, the hotel was also kind of a SRO, which meant, you know, kind of a single room occupancy, last ditch alternative place for people with no resources and no real funds to stay. Mm-hmm. So people like that were in the hotel alongside young budget travelers thinking they were checking into this place called Stay on Main. Yeah. So
including ex-convicts who just got out of prison and probably couldn't pass a background check to get an apartment and that sort of thing. Huh?
Exactly. So an interesting mix of people. Yeah. And so of course, when Elisa Lam, a 21-year-old tourist from Vancouver, disappeared in 2013, people assumed it, you know, something, you know, dark and nefarious mm-hmm. happened to her because of this, because of the history of the hotel. And the LAPD released, because they thought it was a missing persons case for a while. She checked into the hotel, never checked out. Parents became concerned when they stopped hearing from her. And it was initially a missing persons case, and they just literally had no clues other than this elevator footage, this closed circuit security footage of her on an elevator acting very strangely. And that footage was released by the Los Angeles Police Department in the hopes of getting help from the public. And little did they realize that the combination of the history of the hotel with the bizarre behavior that was being exhibited by Elisa Lam in the video footage, in the hotel, in the elevator footage, the combination of the two just created this wild storm of speculation and and interest. And that video went viral. And I remember seeing the video.
Right. And I want to get to that. Yeah, I want to talk about the Elisa Lam case. But before I do that, I do want to give people a little bit more of the fascinating history of this place and why people make these assumptions about it and why it's so infamous. Indeed, you know, its infamy preceded the central event in your show in 2013 and continues long after that. Some in the documentary even say it's haunted or that it's just an inherently evil place. But if nothing else, there certainly appears to be a stain on this hotel that it just can't shake, huh?
Yeah. You know, interestingly, though, I think what I wanted to do with this show, because I'm not the first person to tell the story of the Hotel Cecil, a lot of people want to ascribe spooky ghost story, you know, evil, presence of evil kind of you know, phenomenon to this situation. But, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do the show was to kind of pick all that apart, because I don't think there's anything evil or spooky going on. I think there's a lot of strange coincidences and there's a lot of bizarre, interesting, as Josh Dean in the show says, synchronicities, a lot of strange coincidences from, you know, I don't want to spoil it too much for people who haven't seen it, but, you know, from the, there's a Japanese movie that, you know, prior to Elisa Lam's death, you know, is almost a play-by-play a story summation of what actually happens to Elisa, you know, later. And so people speculated, was this a serial killer playing out the beats of a movie and using that movie as an inspiration? So there's all sorts of strange coincidences, but, you know, to me, it's not supernatural and it's not a ghost story. And one of the things that one must be conscious of when in this area of filmmaking around true crime is that you have to be responsible to the victim. And I think it's extremely irresponsible and a disservice to the memory of the victim, Elisa Lam, to dismiss this whole thing as a ghost story, you know?
Right.
So, so to me, this is not a ghost story. To me, this is, you know, just a strange confluence of ingredients. And that's what the, you know, by studying a location of what produces crime or the perception of crime, that's what I mean, what this series wants to do. It's like to pick apart the urban legend, the myth, and really look at it from a socioeconomic standpoint. What is it about this particular area that produced a hotel that was the nexus of all of this criminal activity?
Right. And, you know, it's kind of the hidden secret of the hospitality industry that people just die in hotels. That happens. Anytime you have 200, 500, in the case of the Cecil, I think 600 or 700 rooms and guests, it's just the law of averages that you will have some occasional deaths. Most of the time, you know, maybe a 90-year-old checks in, dies of natural causes or accidental deaths in the bathroom. You know, also, a lot of people choose to check into a hotel when they're going to commit suicide for some reason. But I wonder, does the Cecil have a higher than usual number of deaths for a hotel and deaths of suspicious or really tragic nature?
It is true that the Cecil has a higher than average kind of index rate of the number of crimes and strange happenings and the suicides and things like that. It is true. It had a higher than average amount, and I attribute that to, you know, the state of disrepair that Los Angeles allowed downtown LA to turn into, combined with, you know, a building that was once luxurious and stood the test of time. I mean, that hotel has really good bones. It was not an obvious candidate. You know, many times when neighborhoods fall into disrepair, the buildings go with it and become unhabitable or torn down and then eventually renovated. You know, this was a particularly sound structure in a great part of town in the 20s. And then, you know, as the Depression hit, as, you know, social and economic policies about how to deal with mental health, people with mental health problems evolved in the 60s, as people were let out of institutions and brought to Skid Row, as Skid Row was allowed to fester, you know, and grow to the point where it's today, there's still a huge homeless problem, you know, obviously exacerbated by COVID. That is what produced an area where you're going to have a lot of people staying in a place that, you know, produces crime or suicide, self-inflicted pain. But it also, the reputation then feeds upon itself. You know, the more the place is known as the place to go commit suicide, for example, the more it becomes an option for people who are contemplating that tragic outcome.
Yeah. And some of the interviews for the show appear to take place in dingy hotel hallways and other hotel-like locations. Did you actually shoot in the Cecil, or was the set? Because I can certainly understand why the owners of the hotel might not be so thrilled to have you there highlighting the hotel's worst moments.
Yeah. I mean, look, we shot the exteriors of the hotel and wanted to really give a sense of the geography. Again, I don't want to give spoilers here about why we wanted a lot of exterior shooting, but the hotel was not open for habitation other than, you know, long-term residents at the time. So we really didn't shoot inside the hotel. We went to a neighboring hotel that was in an equally state of disrepair and did our interviews there because we did want the interviews to have a hotel vibe to it for obvious reasons, but we didn't actually shoot in the Cecil. There's a ton of archival footage from those web sleuths that have, you know, that show us the interior of the hotel when they were able to get in years prior. We covered the hotel significantly from the outside. So I think you really get a sense because it's a character in the show, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And you also interview the former GM of the hotel who ran that hotel for, I think, about a decade. My God, what a crazy horror show that must have been. She's got some stories. Did you ask her how she managed to last there for so long?
I did. I mean, she enjoyed her job. She didn't know what she was getting herself into. She didn't have hotel experience prior to, so maybe she wasn't, to her, it seemed like just an interesting unfolding adventure. And I'm very proud she actually agreed because she's, you know, there's a number of people in this show that have never appeared in other iterations of the telling of this story. And I think she responded to the fact that I wanted to kind of debunk the ghost story aspect of it and talk about it more, you know, from a socioeconomic standpoint and to, you know, also look at all the circumstantial evidence that the web sleuths were assuming something nefarious had happened when in fact, again, I don't want to spoil it for people, but, you know, the circumstantial evidence, even though it's strong, as I have learned in all of my criminal investigations, is that you can't just rely on circumstantial evidence. There needs to be corroborating forensic evidence. And, you know, she was happy that I was taking, you know, that kind of a more intellectual approach to the story. So she agreed, and it was great to have her. You know, we have one of the lead investigators who hasn't talked to other shows before. He agreed because of the idea of how I wanted to, you know, unpack the story. Of course, there's Pablo Vergara, who's the death metal musician who was cyber bullied and people were convinced he was the murderer. And he almost committed suicide because of the how mean and destructive people were to him. So I think the show really went out of its way to give a more clear-eyed dissection of what really happened and why than I think has been done in the past.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment.
Let's talk about Elisa Lam. You know, like I said, I'm from LA, so I remember this being a huge story in the local press, but I don't know how much folks outside of LA know of it. Who was Elisa Lam? What brought her to LA? And how did it first become apparent that she might be missing?
Yeah, Elisa Lam was a 21-year-old student from Vancouver and was kind of taking her first big trip alone. I think that's one of the reasons that everyone, you know, relates to the story, why it went viral, because she posted about her experiences on Tumblr, and we bring that to life in the show. You know, we all had that moment in our life where we're going to just kind of stake our claim, and it's almost a rite of passage, you know, that pilgrimage where you kind of take your own little trip, whether it's with a friend or alone, you know, that first real trip that you take by yourself, you know, to start seeing the world. And of course, you know, that's what she was doing. She was taking a kind of a West Coast tour, starting in San Diego and ending in San Francisco. And midway, she stopped in Los Angeles and checked into the, what she thought was the Stay on Main Hotel, which was a hostel for budget travelers within the Hotel Cecil. She was in daily contact via text with her family. And, you know, late in January of 2013, those texts stopped coming. Her parents became concerned. After a couple of days, they reached out to the Los Angeles Police Department that treated it as a missing persons case.
And when the story originally broke in 2013, the public, the news media, and bloggers became obsessed with the CCTV footage of Elisa seemingly acting very strangely in the hotel elevator. You mentioned a little bit about this before. It kind of led to people theorizing that someone was chasing her, she was haunted by a ghost, someone working at the hotel might be controlling the elevator, even that the footage might have been edited by someone, all kinds of theories. I wonder, in hindsight, did the investigators you spoke with express any regrets about releasing that video? Maybe like it did more harm than good.
I don't think they regret it because it was a missing persons case. They had no information, no clues. There was no footage of her leaving the hotel because they, you know, there were closed circuit TVs, you know, in several locations. The only known footage of her was her acting, you know, inexplicably strange in this elevator footage. So I don't think they regret releasing it, but I certainly don't think they anticipated the kind of reaction that it received. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think anyone expected it to go viral. I don't think anyone in the police department expected them to be accused of a cover-up. So I don't think they regret it. I didn't specifically ask that question. It's a good one. I should have asked it. I think they weren't expecting the reaction, you know? Sure. But it is, you know, in a missing persons case, when you have literally no evidence and you're, you know, seeking information from the public, you know, it kind of made sense to release it.
Mm-hmm. But that's one thing that I guess people don't always realize. The police don't always share everything that they have with the general public, and for good reasons, especially when it comes to a possible homicide case. I wonder if you think that the public, and particularly this community of online web sleuths that you talk to, who sort of made it their mission to solve this mystery, if they maybe assumed that they had a fuller picture of what happened than they really did.
Oh, very much so. And that's a great point. That's one of the themes of the show. And look, it's hard to paint a broad brush with everybody the same way. I think the web sleuths were well-intentioned. I think they were trying to help. I think, but I think they also maybe had seen too many true crime shows.
So you share a little bit of blame here then too.
I guess so. I've seen, you know, web sleuths, amateur investigators, whatever people, you know, I've seen good and bad. I mean, if we go back to the days of Paradise Lost, when the original movie came out in 1996, it was just at the beginning of the internet as we know it. It's what I call social media 1.0. There was no social media as we know it, but people were building websites and like-minded people were finding each other, you know, and communities were being created online through chats and, you know, chat groups and things like that for the first time. You know, it was still pretty fresh in, you know, late 95, early 96. And when Paradise Lost came out, it just created a firestorm of interest of people believing that Damien Echols and the other Jason Baldwin, Jesse Miscali were innocent. And I was, you know, over the 2 decades that I made three with Bruce Sanofsky, three Paradise Lost films that eventually 18 and a half years later led to the release of the West Memphis Three. You know, the films have been given a lot of credit over the years for liberating the West Memphis Three from wrongful convictions. But, and not to sound falsely humble, I mean, the films do deserve some credit, but really they were the catalyst for all these people who, you know, spent their vacations from work going down to Arkansas to, you know, demonstrate anytime there was an appeals hearing to like keep the police and the investigation going. So the amateur investigators, quote unquote, who saw Paradise Lost and were just, you know, felt like a real miscarriage of justice had taken place, they were an incredibly positive force that are as responsible for the West Memphis Three getting out of prison as my and Bruce Sanofsky's film series. Cut to 2013, you know, there have been other online investigations, web sleuth investigators that have had a positive impact on cases, but, you know, it has a dark side, as we show in the show, you know, the cyberbullying of Morbid, you know, the death metal musician who they assumed was the murderer of Elisa Lam. You know, he basically was digitally run out of town. I mean, all of his social media accounts were shut down. He lost a lot of original masters that unfortunately had only been up on YouTube. Why that is, I don't know, but that was the case. And he contemplated suicide and so that's not good.
No, certainly.
There's a wide range of, so that's why I say it's hard to like say it's all bad, all good, but, the point of the show really is that, you know, there's an explanation for everything, and relying on circumstantial evidence without the proper corroborating forensic evidence is dangerous. It's dangerous in wrongful convictions because it happens all the time, and it's dangerous that a bunch of people assume something nefarious has happened when there's another explanation.
Yeah, I really feel for that musician. I think his name was Morbid, and he kind of had a Marilyn Manson goth kind of vibe, death metal vibe. So I kind of can understand how people might mistake art for reality and think that he's living out his fantasies or something like that. But God, I really feel for him. I mean, according to him, these people basically ruined his life.
Yeah.
Why did they target him? What made him such an attractive suspect to them?
Well, as we learn in the series, he stayed at the Cecil a year before her disappearance. He then wrote some songs, and those songs came out around the time of Elisa's disappearance. That talk about chasing down and killing somebody and sending them, you know, deep in the water. And again, we don't want to give some spoilers here, but the lyrics, the lyrics talk about China, talk about water, all, Elisa was a, Chinese Canadian citizen. There was just a lot of associations between the lyrics of his songs and what the Webb sleuths perceived happened as a murder case. On the other hand, as plain as day, and he put it out there and nobody chose to listen, he was in a studio in Mexico recording an album. He had signed contracts. He had stamps in his passport to prove his travel dates. He had verifiable proof to show he wasn't in Los Angeles at the time of the disappearance. And yet that wasn't listened to for some reason.
Yeah. In fact, from day one, many of these Webb sleuths seem to have become convinced that Lisa Lam's death was foul play. And for many of them, just no amount of evidence to the contrary would persuade them otherwise. And it's just a fascinating picture of how they reframe things to fit their preferred narrative. And that could also be applied to QAnon and the politics right now and so forth. But what were some of the other conspiracy theories that they came up with to explain this, and who all, according to them, was involved in the death and supposed cover up here?
Right. Well, because it looked like there was some tampering with the video, the timestamp had been obliterated. There was a little bit of footage missing. The footage was slowed down. So people assumed that there was some kind of cover up, either involving hotel employees or for some reason the LAPD was covering it up. There was a mistake of a date that was then crossed out and changed on the coroner's report. That was looked at as a possible cover-up evidence. It ran the gamut. You kind of hit the nail on the head while you were talking about its connection today. One of the things, I can't say I did the show for this reason. That would be, too convenient. But I, as a maker of nonfiction over the decades, have been very concerned and very interested in what is the nature of truth, and what is an objective truth, because all documentary filmmaking, for example, is inherently subjective. Nothing is the absolute truth about anything, because it's, we could talk about that forever. That's a bit of a tangent. But the point is, the nature of truth is something I've always been concerned with as a maker of nonfiction, film and television. But never could I have dreamed that we would get to the place where we are in society, where we're really in a post-truth world, where whoever presents the best narrative seems to be, in some people's minds, the purveyor of the truth. It's deeply divided our country. The very definition of democracy is the ability to compromise. I think we are no longer able to compromise because people are entrenched into their very deeply held beliefs, of which half the people are wrong. I don't want to say who's wrong, but there seems to be no objective truth anymore.
Yeah.
And that's, it's those kind of phenomenon, for example, that lead to wrongful convictions. Damien Echols was, sentenced to death in Arkansas because of he listened to Metallica and read Stephen King books, because nothing else was presented at trial. There was no forensic evidence, no blood at the crime scene. And so this show for me is again, I didn't make it for this reason, but it's become very much a meditation for me on the nature of truth and on the importance of, having corroborating evidence for anything you're claiming. And unfortunately, there was just a lot of circumstantial evidence and a lot of strange coincidences, which I admit are strange and entertaining, therefore. But there's no replacement for verifiable truth.
Yeah. And on a lighter note, you actually talk with a British couple that sort of accidentally booked themselves into the Cecil at the time. And they have sort of this crazy horror show experience at the hotel, and indeed end up being the first people to report that something was wrong with the tap water that eventually leads investigators to discover the body of Lisa Lam in the tanks above. I can't even imagine what kind of Yelp review they must have left. But I wonder if, with the explosion of true crime as entertainment, does the Cecil still run away from its reputation, or is the lore around the Cecil starting to become an attraction for some tourists?
Oh, I think, true crime has always been entertaining. has, you know, the history, the criminal history of places has always, you know, fed upon itself. So I think that's not new. And I don't think even after my dissection of the truth, I don't think, you know, I think that's going to be a famous place that people want to visit and interact with. You know, but I hope, you know, in telling the story, by me not pandering to the ghost story element and by trying to pull back and have a deeper understanding of how these false ideas come to be, I hope some people will, you know, take the lesson that you really need to, you know, have verifiable facts before you, you know, accuse somebody of murder.
Mm-hmm. Well, real quickly before we go, do you know yet what the setting will be for the next installment of Crime Scene?
I do, because we're shooting it already, even under COVID conditions. But unfortunately, we've made we've made the decision not to tell people yet where we're doing it. But there is a season two, very different place.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a lot of speculation already. Well, once more, the first installment of Joe Berlinger's new docuseries, Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, streams on Netflix starting February 10th. Joe, what a story. Thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me, man. Always a pleasure.
Thanks again to Joe Berlinger for coming on the show. Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel is now streaming only on Netflix. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.